Well, good evening again, class. It's good to be back again for another night in the book of Daniel. I invite you to move forward if you desire. And we're going to continue on in the book of Daniel tonight. We're looking at chapter 7 and 8. We're looking primarily at prophecy. I'm going to try to get through it all tonight. That way, tomorrow night to wrap up, we can study a little more applicable lesson for us on Daniel and the Lion's Den and how that applies to our lives today. So tonight is Daniel chapter 7 and 8. And we're looking at the book of Daniel. Purpose, prayer, and prophecy are three themes that we're seeing come through. Chapter 1, what was chapter 1 about? Not eating the king's meat, being captive. He was probably around 13 to 17 years old. Scholars estimate somewhere in there. Daniel chapter 2 happened 2 years later, making him 2 years older. And what happened in chapter 2? Nebuchadnezzar's dream. The king has a dream and he puts his wise men to a test. And he asked them to tell them the dream and the interpretation. Chapter 3. What was in chapter 3? The fiery furnace. Very famous children's story. And probably 10, we don't know exactly how many years later, but a few years later. Chapter 4. We looked at last evening. What was in chapter 4? The humbling of King Nebuchadnezzar, very good. Nebuchadnezzar, he goes in and is walking in his palace, and he's like, look at this magnificent palace, this great Babylon that I had built from my might. And God humbles him. He becomes like a beast for 7 years. Chapter 5, we read about what? There were handwriting on the wall, very good. Hopefully, till the end of this week, you can have this memorized, what the first six chapters are about. The history. Chapters 1 through 6 are primarily history. They're stories, different accounts of Daniel. They're very fascinating stories. I think they're an easy read for any one of us because of how interesting they are. Chapter 7 through 12 is primarily prophecy or visions. And another thing to note about Daniel is chapter 2, verse 4 to the end of chapter 7 is written in Aramaic, the language of the Gentiles. All right, we're going to keep things moving. Tonight, I want to look at this verse from 2 Peter chapter 1. It says, for we have not followed cunningly devised fables. You know, there are devout Christians, and I trust us here, we're devout Christians, but there are also devout Muslims, there's devout Buddhists, there's devout people of a lot of different religions. How do you know you're following the right religion? How do you know you're following the true God? And Peter says in verse 16, end of verse 16, it says, but we're eyewitnesses of his majesty. So Peter was there firsthand. You were not. You didn't see Christ physically walking the earth. You didn't spend 3 years with him. But he says in verse 19, the verse I've highlighted there, we have a more sure word of prophecy. So even more than being eyewitnesses, Peter's saying we have a sure word of prophecy. Now, I used to be a math teacher, and so I'm going to give you a quick math lecture. Just going to take 2 minutes, but we got to get this in. We got to get some arithmetic in here somehow. So we're going to learn about composite probabilities, okay? So I have 100 people on the left side, and let's imagine in here there's 100 people in this room, and 30% of them would be teenagers. That would look right like that. We have 30 of them circled. Now, let's say the same 100 people in here, 30% are teenagers, or 0.3 are teenagers. Let's say 50% of the people in here have brown eyes. So that would look like that, okay? Exactly half of them are circled, 50 of them are circled. So now we have, so composite probability is what is the likelihood that someone is a brown-eyed teenager in here, okay? Using those two that we looked at, you would take 0.3, for the teenagers, and 0.5 for the brown eyes, times each other, that'll come to 0.15, and you'll notice, let me get my laser started here, you'll notice in this circle here, it will be a total of 15, okay? That's called composite probabilities. Now, the reason I share that, because I want to share with you a study. When I was teaching at Gaiman's, I was teaching a class on creation, and then for their test, I put a wig on, so I didn't look quite like my usual self. And I pretended to be an atheist, and I had the students debate me one-on-one. And that was a good discussion, but then at the end, I showed them this here to try to convince them that I wasn't actually an atheist. I did actually believe in Jesus. But Peter Stoner at Bethesda College, he did this test with some of his students. And they took 8 of the Old Testament prophecies about Jesus, and only 8. There's over 300. They took 8 of them, and they're going to find out what is the probability of somebody actually fulfilling these prophecies. So they looked at 8, and the first one they looked at was Micah 5:2. Jesus will be born in Bethlehem. So they divided the average population of Bethlehem by the average population of the world. And they came down to a very conservative number of 1 in every 280,000 people are born in Bethlehem. So now, using composite probabilities, which I just explained to you, they looked at the second prophecy. Malachi 3 verse 1, a messenger will come before Jesus, or a forerunner. We know John the Baptist came before Jesus. So, and they found the probability of that happening to be 1 in 1,000. The third prophecy they looked at was Zechariah 9:9, riding on a donkey into Jerusalem as king. And they, so somebody that was born in Bethlehem that has a forerunner, 1 out of 100 of them are going to ride into Jerusalem as king on a donkey. Again, these are very conservative. They always rounded down. They always took very conservative approaches. Verse 4, or sorry, not verse 4, the fourth one, Zechariah 13:6, betrayed by a friend and has wounds in his hand. They did that 1 in 1,000. The fifth one, the prophecy looked at, Zechariah 11, they betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. So somebody that meets the first four criteria, 1 in 1,000 would be betrayed for 30 pieces of silver. The sixth prophecy, Zechariah 11:13, potter field bought with the money thrown in the temple floor. We know all this was fulfilled from the New Testament. And they put that as 1 in 100,000. Again, these are conservative estimates. Isaiah 53:7, made no defense on trial. 1 in 1,000. And the last of the eight that they took, and there's, like I said, there's well over 300, they took Psalms 22, crucified, hands and feet pierced, and they put that as 1 in 10,000. So they added all these up, and if you're, I'm not very good at math, but it comes, using their numbers, it comes to 2.8 times 10 to the 28th. So in other words, there's 28 zeros on behind. And they reduced that down to 10 to the 28th. Okay, so now they assumed that there was 88 billion people. Again, they're taking very conservative numbers. 88 billion people lived between the day of the prophecies until now. So they divided 10 to the 28th by 88 billion, and it comes to 1 to 10 to the 17th. So 10 with the 17 zeros on behind. So the chances of a man just randomly fulfilling these Old Testament prophecies is this, 1 to 10 and the 17th. Now, to explain how big of a number this is, we have the state of Pennsylvania here. This is 2 scale. I overlaid it over top of the state of Texas. Pennsylvania fits into Texas about 6 times, area-wise, okay? And now here I overlaid Texas over top of Europe, just to show how big the state of Texas is. And they use this college, Peter Stoner, to get like a visual for us, they came up with this math, and I double-checked it. I think they're accurate. This visual was that they took dollar coins, okay? We know what a size of dollar coin is. It's bigger than a quarter. And if they would cover the state of Texas 2 feet thick, that would be 1 times 10 to the 17th, okay? The entire state of Texas, which is 6 times bigger than PA, 2 feet thick with quarters. So that would be like covering the entire state of Texas 2 feet thick with quarters, with dollar coins, and then getting a Sharpie, putting an X on one of them, stirring up the whole state, and then having a blindfolded person randomly grab one try. And if he will get that one, we know that's not possible, right? And that's the likelihood of somebody just coming along randomly and fulfilling all these prophecies. Then Peter Stoner and his students, they added 8 more. They went to 16 prophecies, and that would be equally, that. I won't bother, I'll just say it real quick. It would be like the using the earth as a core, and having dollar coins extend in all directions 30 times past the sun, and then stirring it up and having one person randomly choose would be the equivalent. Then you go into 48 prophecies, and it gets into atoms, and you can read it. You can just Google Peter Stoner, Evidence Speaks, I think is what the book's called, and you can read about it yourself. I get lost when I try to explain the atoms and molecules and how that is. But either way, what I'm saying all this by is fulfilled prophecy not only proves the Bible is true, it also proves that Jesus is the Messiah. And it should strengthen our faith as believers to see fulfilled prophecy. It should make us know that we are following the one true God when we see this. And I find it exciting, even though it can be debatable and people argue about whether this fulfilled that. And so anyway, tonight we're going to look at some fulfilled prophecy in Daniel chapter 7, Daniel chapter 8. I want to bring your attention back to Nebuchadnezzar's dream in chapter 2. We have the head of gold representing the Babylonian Empire, the chest of silver, the waist of bronze, and then the legs of iron. And then we had that stone that was cut without hands that just ground it to powder. We're going to be looking at some of these same kingdoms represented in a different way. Daniel chapter 7. And growing up, I often heard the period between the Old Testament and New Testament described as silent years. Well, Daniel details out what events. They're not silent at all. Daniel speaks a lot, and if you have time to study into Daniel chapter 11, hopefully I can give you some resources for that. You can see how it's very detailed out, the events that are going to happen. They're not silent at all. All right, and this is the reason that Daniel is so highly criticized, is because the prophecy has come to pass before the time of Christ. Some of these kings and stuff, and scholar or skeptics are like, there's no way a man could have just randomly predicted this. It's not possible. That, and then he attacked the date of it, which there's very strong evidence Daniel was written by Daniel himself. Jesus himself authenticated it. All right, Daniel chapter 7, verse 1. I'm going to read a number of verses, and we're going to come back and explain them. Chapter 7, verse 1. This is written around 555 B.C. We don't know exactly the date. It says the second year of Belshazzar, in the first verse there, or in the first year of Belshazzar. And we don't know exactly when he started reigning. He was put in to reign instead of his father Nabonidus, who was off in Arabia. 7 verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head upon his bed, and he wrote the dream and told us some of the matters. Daniel spake and said, I saw in the vision by night, and behold, the four winds of the heavens strove above the great sea, and four great beasts came up from the sea, diverse one from another. So a beast is an animal. He's seen these four animals. Verse 4. The first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings were plucked thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth, and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Verse 5, and behold, another beast, the second, like to a bear, and it raised up itself on one side, and had three ribs in the mouth of it, between the teeth of it, and they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. Verse 6, after this I beheld, and lo, another, like a leopard, which had upon the back of it four wings of a fowl. The beast also had also four heads, and dominion was given to it. After this, I saw in the night visions, and behold, a fourth beast, dreadful and terrible, and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth. It devoured and brake in pieces, and stamped the residue with the feet of it. It was diverse from all the beasts that were before it, and it had 10 horns. Verse 15. Now we're looking more at the interpretation. I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit in the midst of my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. And I came near unto one of them that stood by, and asked him the truth of all this. So he told me, and he made known the interpretation of the things. These great beasts, which are four kings, which shall arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall take the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever and even forever and ever. All right, back up to verse 4. So we had these four beasts in this vision. The first one was like a lion. It had eagle's wings. So I put a picture, maybe what it will, just to get our minds going. Here is this lion that had eagle's wings. Jeremiah refers to Babylon as a lion. 4 verse 7 refers to Babylon, the lion that has come up from this thicket. Ezekiel 17 refers to Babylon as an eagle. Verse 3, a great eagle with great wings. If you skipped a bunch of verses, tell them, behold, the king of Babylon has come to Jerusalem. So Babylon in Scripture is referred to both a lion and an eagle. Lions also were common in Babylonian art. Ishtar Gate, there was lions painted there. The Babylon Palace, the processional way, the way into the Temple of Marduk, there was lions all along the corridors there. The lion is generally symbolized with Babylon. So the wings were plucked. What happened to King Nebuchadnezzar last night? He was taken from his kingdom, and he was out, though seven times passed over him, eating grass like an oxen. His wings were plucked. And then he was made to stand like a man, given a man's heart or his mind. So I think it's, chapter 8 is going to be much more clear. It's going to actually call out the names of these kings. But now you can say this isn't prophecy because Nebuchadnezzar had already lived and died. At this point, this was under Belshazzar. So Nebuchadnezzar was already dead. This isn't technically prophecy. But it sets the standard to interpret the next two beasts that we look at. Chapter 7, verse 5, and behold, another beast, the second, like to a bear, and it raised itself on one side, and it had three ribs in the mouth of it between the teeth of it, and they said thus unto it, arise, devour much flesh. So we have this here picture. The Medo-Persian Empire from 539 to 331 was led by a man named Cyrus the Great, and that's who I believe the bear is representing. In his dream, is the Medo-Persian Empire, specifically Cyrus the Great, the first emperor. So he's raised up on one side. That's the first description we have of it. And I explained briefly last night that the country of Media was in control of this area, and Persia was kind of a subject state to Media. And then and King Cyrus becomes king of Persia, and Cyrus's grandfather is king of Media. And Persia, with King Cyrus, rises up and overthrows the king in Media, and now he's controlling. Now Cyrus, who started out small here, in Persia is now the dominant side. So they went from Media being in control, Persia being down here, and they flip control. They're controlled, called the Medes and Persians. And it's raised up on one side with Persia being the dominant one. Other detail we have, there was three ribs in its mouth. And most scholars would say that that would represent the three main nations that the Medes and Persians conquered, which would be Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt. Was what the three ribs would symbolize. Let's go on to the next piece. And after this, I beheld, and lo, another like a leopard, which had on the back of it four wings of a fowl, and the beast also had four heads. Dominion was given to it. This would be symbolized a Greek empire led by Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great, notice that the leopard, one other thing I want to say about the bear, is the way the Medes and Persians conquered was just in brute force. They just marched along in symbolic of a bear. Okay? The Greek Empire under Alexander the Great was very symbolic to a leopard or to a bear. They were known for their speed. You see, the leopards are described having four wings. And Alexander the Great took over the empire when he was 20 years old. And one major conquest that he had was placing a siege on the city of Tyre. Tyre, I have a map of it. It had a fortified city out as an island, and then it had the main part of another part of the city on the mainland. And Nebuchadnezzar had placed a siege around the city on the mainland and had destroyed that, but he had placed a siege in there for 13 years and never actually conquered the island city part. And Alexander the Great, in his zeal and energy, he built a causeway. Or in other words, he just filled up the ocean and made a path for his soldiers to go straight out to the island of Tyre and to tackle that way. The people from Tyre actually got it lit on fire and it burnt, and he did it a second time. He finally captured it after only 7 months. Something Nebuchadnezzar tried for 13 years. Alexander the Great did in just 7 months. And there's historians outside of the Bible that record how 6,000 fighting men were killed within the city, and 2,000 Tyrians were crucified on the beach, and there were some 30,000 people that he sold into slavery. And he made... Alexander the Great just made a statement with Tyre. And as he went from there, he went to Egypt. And news of his army spread. People just caved to him. They didn't even put up a fight. They just surrendered. They heard the story of Tyre, the city that shouldn't have been able to conquer. And they just caved to Alexander. And he's known for his speed. He's known for the four wings, I think would symbolize his speed. Even the leopards can, I think, run like a 30-some mile an hour. And He was known for marching his troops just relentlessly, and he would march them just at very unrealistic speeds considering the time. Just keep pushing and pushing and pushing his troops, and he would surprise his enemies by that. They wouldn't have time to assemble together. And legend has it that by the time he was 29 years old, Alexander the Great fell in his bed crying because there was no more worlds left to conquer. He controls the world. Now, what about the four heads? Alexander died at 32 years old, probably of malaria. We don't really know exactly what caused his death, but he got sick and he died. And when he was on his deathbed, they asked him what they should do with his empire. And he said, give it to the strong. And that's not a very clear direction, but when all the dust settled, his four head generals took control of the kingdom, and they divided amongst themselves. We'll get into that in a little more detail in chapter 8. All right, let's keep going. And after this, I saw in night visions, this is now the fourth beast, dreadful and terrible and strong exceedingly, and it had great iron teeth, and it devoured and brake in pieces and stamped the residue with the feet. It was diverse from all the beasts before it, and it had 10 horns. There's different views on this. I'm not going to say a lot on this because this is the first three beasts, everyone agrees upon. The lion, doesn't matter if you're premillennial or amillennial or what, everyone agrees that the lion represents Babylon, the bear represents Medo-Persia, and the leopard represents Greece. It's this fourth beast that there's some discrepancy on, or we don't know. We don't know for sure. And I know some people have very strong opinions. I'm not going to swing one way or the other. But I wanted to read a quote whenever I teach on prophecy, and there's varying opinions. There's a quote by Justin Martyr that I just really, really like. So he's dialoguing with Trypho the Jew here, and Trypho is saying, do you really admit that this place, Jerusalem, is to be rebuilt? Do you expect your people to be gathered together and made joyful in Christ, the patriarchs, the prophets, both the men of our nation and the other proselytes who joined them before your Christ came. And this is Justin. So Dreyfo is expecting Jerusalem to be rebuilt. And Justin's saying, I admitted to you formally and that I and many others are of this opinion. So Justin believed that Jerusalem was going to be rebuilt. And such will take place. Of this you are surely aware. But notice what he says on that I have highlighted there. On the other hand, I indicated to you that many who belong to the pure and pious faith are true Christians and think otherwise. And I think that's the challenge we think when we see somebody that doesn't believe eschatology or end times or prophecy the same way we do. We tend to think, oh, they don't believe the Bible, then they don't. But I like his attitude here, that there can be other people that belong to the pure and pious faith and are true Christians that believe different than we do when it comes to different end times views. All right, Daniel chapter 8. We're going to skip the rest of 7, mainly about that beast, and we're going to try to get through some of Daniel chapter 8. This is much more detailed. And notice now Daniel chapter 8 switches back to being written in Hebrew. Okay? And now it is also starting to concern the Jews again. Daniel chapter 8 verse 1. In the third year of the reign of King Belshazzar, a vision appeared unto me, even unto me, Daniel, after that which appeared unto me at the first. So it's the third year. The chapter 7 was what year, Belshazzar? Didn't we remember? It was the first. Yeah. So this is 2 years later. And I saw in a vision, and it came to pass when I saw that I was at Shushan in the palace, which is in the province of Elam, and I saw in a vision, and I was by the river Ulai. So he was in the palace at Shushan, and he's at two different places here. And then when he's in the vision, it's by the river. And what else happens at the palace of Shushan? There's some other events in the Bible that talk about this. Esther, very good. And one other one. I just put it up there. Esther and Nehemiah. And Nehemiah 1:1 says, I was in Shushan the palace. Esther 1:2 says, which was in Shushan the palace. So most likely both. Esther and Nehemiah were at the same palace where Daniel is talking about. And there's a map. I put circles where Babylon is, the red where they think Shushan would have been, and then where that river was. All right, so that's the setting. Let's get into the prophecy. Chapter 8, verse 3. Then I lifted up mine eyes and saw, and behold, there stood before the river a ram which had two horns, and two horns were high, but one was higher than the other. And the higher came up last. Notice the details. Verse 4, I saw the ram pushing westward, there's three directions, northward and southward, so that no beast might stand before him. Neither was there any that could deliver out of his hand, but he did according to his will and became great. And as I was considering, behold, a he-goat came from the west on the face of the whole earth and touched not the ground. And the goat had a notable horn between his eyes. Verse 6, and he came to the ram that had two horns, which I had seen standing before the river, and ran into him in the fury of his power. And I saw him come close unto the ram, and he was moved with choler against him, and smote the ram, and brake his two horns, and there was no power in the ram to stand before him. But he cast him down to the ground, and stamped on him, and there was none that could deliver the ram out of his hand. Verse 8, therefore the he-goat waxed very great, and when he was strong, the great horn was broken, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. Maybe you're seeing some parallel to chapter 7, verse 15. So now we're going to look at the meaning of this. And it came to pass, when I, Daniel, had seen the vision and sought for the meaning, behold, there stood before me as the appearance of a man, and I heard a man's voice between the banks of Ulai, which called and said, Gabriel, make this man to understand the vision. And so he came near where I stood, and when he came, I was afraid, and fell upon my face. And he said unto me, understand, O son of man, for at the time of the end shall be the vision. Now as he was speaking to me, I was in a deep sleep with my face toward the ground, but he touched me and set me upright. And he said, behold, I will make thee know what shall be in the last end of the indignation, and at the time appointed the end shall be. Verse 20, now he's explaining it. The ram which thou sawest, having two horns, are the kings of Media and Persia. This time, chapter 8 doesn't leave any doubt. It says exactly what it is. And it's also interesting to note that the ram symbolized the Persian. Fourth century Roman historians record that the Persian kings going into battle would put a ram's head or ram's horns on their head when they're going into battle. It was kind of their, I don't know if you could call it a mascot or what, but it was something that was associated with them. verse chapter 8, verse 21. Now it's explaining the goat. And the rough goat is the king of Grecia, or Greece. And the great horn that is between his eyes is the first king. Now that being broken, whereas four stood up for it, four kingdoms shall stand up out of the nation, but not in his power. Notice the detail that's happening, that he's describing here. So now we know who the ram and who the goat is. Let's go back and look at some more of the details. Verse 3 again. There was a ram which had two horns, and the two horns were high, but the one was higher than the other, and the higher one came up last. And it was pushing westward, northward. Let's look at some details. So the ram had two horns. One was higher than the other. The higher one came up last, and it was pushing in three different directions. Yeah, I explained this earlier, but Cyrus became king of Persia, and he overthrew his grandpa. So the Medes were in control. They were in control. Persia was subject to them. And then Cyrus became king of Persia, and he flipped that. He attacked the Medes, and he became in control. The Medes were... there was one source that said that they were used more as like a slang term. It was like a derogatory term to be called a Mede. So now the Persians are in control. And notice the detail that matches. The ram with two horns, one higher than the other. The higher one came up last. Cyrus came up last. He defeated his grandfather. It fulfills it to the detail. And it says the ram was pushing west, north, and south. And that would indicate the three directions that Cyrus, for the three main battles or the three kingdoms that he conquered Lydia to the north, Babylon to the west, and Egypt to the south. It fits it very, very well to the details. And not only that, if you look at Macedonian coins, there's often like a goat on it. So a goat actually symbolized, God knew what he was doing and putting that specific animal, associating it with that kingdom. I'm getting ahead of myself. I had animals mixed up there. Now we're getting into the goat, which was associated with Greece or Macedonia, symbolized on their coins and stuff. Verse 5, and it talks about the goat, that his feet didn't touch the ground. It came from the west. And let's look at how Alexander fulfills that. Remember the leopard that had four heads and with four wings? Alexander was known for his speed. He marched his troops relentlessly to surprise his enemies, to get them, attack them before they were ready. And this goat doesn't have his feet touching the ground. What direction did Alexander come from? If you can associate, like, he would have come from Greece. He would have come from the west. He matches that aspect very clearly. And he ran over the ram. It said in 3 years, with three major battles, Alexander conquered Persia. And he overthrew the ram. And then when he was strong, the great horn was broken. Remember it said, and later on when I was explaining the dream, that the great horn was the first king. We know that Alexander died when he was 32 years old in June of the year 323. And then it says that it was going to, and for it came up four notable ones toward the four winds of heaven. And there are four of his generals on his deathbed. He said, give it to the strong. And his four generals took control of the empire. So the great horn is Alexander, the great horn in the vision is Alexander the Great, the four kingdoms that stand up. Not in his power, none of them were as strong as he was. Cassander was the one, Lysacamus, I know I'm saying that wrong, but I know how to say it, it's slipping my mind right now. And Seleucus and Ptolemy. Seleucus and Ptolemy are the main two. Daniel chapter 11 refers to the king of the north and the king of the south. It's referring to Seleucus and Ptolemy. They battle back and forth. But that's another prophecy for another time. All right, so far we looked in Daniel chapter 8. We've looked in verses 1 and 2 at the setting. We looked at verses 3 and 8, the vision of the ram and the goat. We looked at verses 15 to 18 when Gabriel was sent to explain it to Daniel. We looked at verses 19 to 22, where the vision of the ram and the goat are explained. But we missed verses 9 to 14, and we missed verses 23 to 26, the explanation of the little horn and Daniel's reaction. So we dealt with the easier items, now we get to some of the harder, more in-depth. So stick with me, we'll get through this fairly quickly. Verse 9, the verse we missed. And out of one of them, referring to one of the four horns that rose up in place of the great horn, referring to Alexander, one of Alexander, the four generals, Out of one of them came forth a little horn, which waxed exceeding great, toward the south, toward the east, and toward the pleasant land. And it waxed great, even to the host of heaven, and it came down, and it cast down some of the hosts of the stars to the ground, and stamped upon them. Yea, he magnified himself, even to the prince of the host, and by him the daily sacrifice was taken away, and the place of the sanctuary was cast down. And a host was given him against the daily sacrifice by reason of transgression, and it cast down the truth to the ground, and it practiced and prospered. Then I heard one saint speaking, and another saint said unto that certain saint which spake, How long shall be the vision concerning the daily sacrifice and the transgression of desolation to give both the sanctuary and the host to be trodden underfoot? And he said unto me, Unto 2,300 days, then shall the sanctuary be cleansed. Now we're going to verse 23, the fulfillment of this. And in the latter time of their kingdom, when the transgressors are come to the full, a king of fierce countenance and understanding dark sentences shall stand up, and his power shall be mighty, but not by his own power. He shall destroy wonderfully, and shall prosper and practice, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. And through his policy he shall cause craft to prosper in his hand, and he shall magnify himself in his heart, and by peace shall destroy many. He shall also stand up against the prince of princes, but he shall be broken without hand. And the vision of the evening and the morning which was told is true. Wherefore shut thou up the vision, for it shall be for many days. All right, so let's back up a little bit. We're going to go through some of these details and spell them out. I want to introduce you to a man by the name of Antiochus. So the Seleucid Empire, the four generals, if you remember that, it was orange on the map. He would have been the eighth ruler. His name was Antiochus IV, or he's known as Antiochus Epiphanes. If you look at most of your study Bibles in this chapter, he'll be listed there and different of his what he did. Antiochus Epiphanes lived from around the year 215. We don't know exactly when he was born, but he died in 164. And he was, it says here in Scripture, he's going to be a little horn, but he's going to grow great. Antiochus was the son of Antiochus III. But he was the second son. He had an older brother that was in line to the throne. And Antiochus was actually a captive in Rome. He was a political captive in Rome. So he's there probably in a pretty nice jail. He's a political captive. And his brother is reigning. And somehow Antiochus comes up with a plan to get him swapped out for his brother's son, Demetrius, who is heir to the throne. So they switch positions. And Demetrius is now this captive in Rome. And Antiochus IV, is now free. His brother, Seleucus, is reigning, and he gets murdered in the year 175. And his oldest son, Demetrius, is captive in Rome, where Antiochus was supposed to have been. So Antiochus sets Demetrius' other son, who's an infant, on the throne, and says, I'm going to be co-ruler with him. I'm going to be co-ruler. So Antiochus was not entitled to the throne. Okay, he was a little horn. He was not supposed to be in line for the throne, but he sets his nephew, who was in line, and his nephew that's supposed to be king is in jail in Rome, so he sets his younger nephew on the throne, says, I'm going to be co-ruler with you, and then he murders him and claims the throne for himself. So that's how Antiochus came on the throne. He had, it says that in understanding dark sentences, New King James translated that as sinister schemes. And that kind of portrays exactly how he operated and how he got on the throne. That fits very well with him. He was also very crafty when he attacked Egypt. He did not destroy the capital so that Rome wouldn't get upset. And he was a very crafty individual. You can read a lot in history about him. And he attacked primarily in three directions. Notice in verse 9 it says toward the east. He conquered the eastern part of the Seleucid Empire. And then he was the first Seleucid to conquer Egypt. He conquered to the south. And then the third direction is towards the pleasant land, which would be Jerusalem or Israel. And he conquered there as well. And notice it says in the latter time of their kingdom. After Antiochus dies, the kingdom majorly deteriorates. And by the year 130, they lost all the lands west of the Euphrates. And when the Romans came in around year 64, it was no longer an empire. The empire collapsed. It holds very true to the latter time of their kingdom. All right, verse 10. And it waxed great, even to the host of heaven, and it cast down some of the host and of the stars to the ground and stamped upon them. Verse 23 interprets that, and shall destroy the mighty and the holy people. So he attacks the Jews. It says one other place that through peace he destroys many. He takes away the daily sacrifice. And I'm not going to get into a lot of that. I had put a bunch of verses on here from 1 Maccabees. You can read about that. It used to, if you search 1 Maccabees, some groups would consider that part of canon. We do not hold that as part of canon, but I think everyone agrees that it's accurate history. And it talks in there, if you read 1 Maccabees chapter 1, Antiochus forbids burnt offerings. For the sake of time, I'm going to skip reading this. I'm going to start here, verse 57. Let me start reading in verse 54. And in the 145th year, just to give an idea what this guy was like, they set up the abomination of desolation upon the altar and built idol altars throughout the cities of Judah on every side and burnt incense at the doors of their houses and in the streets. And when they had rent in pieces the books of the law which they had found, they burnt with fire. And whosoever was found with any book of the Testament, or if any committed to the law, the king's commandment was that they should put him to death. So Antiochus was putting anybody to death who was found with the Old Testament, or with the Torah. And thus they did by their authority unto the Israelites every month as to as many as were found in the cities. And on the 25th day of the month they did sacrifice upon the idol altar which was upon the altar of God. And at the time according to the commandment they put to death certain women who had caused their children to be circumcised. They hanged their infants around their necks. They rifled their houses. They slew them that had circumcised them. Howbeit many in Israel were fully resolved and confirmed in themselves not to eat anything unclean. Wherefore they chose rather to die that they might not be defiled with meats, that they might not profane the Holy Covenant, and so they died. And there was very great wrath upon Israel. Just a brief summary, what he did to the Jews. He forbid sacrifices and offerings. He profaned the Sabbath. He destroyed the Torah. He forbid reading the Torah. He commanded to eat pork, to not circumcise your children, to worship Zeus, or be killed. It was death penalty. And you can read some of the things that take place and how the Jews suffered. There's an account where he killed 40,000 in 2 days. And he sent 40,000 away as captives in that same amount of time, sort of 80,000 people affected. To the temple, he sold the high priest position twice. He plundered the temple, and he stopped the daily sacrifices, burnt offerings, and drink offerings, and then he sacrificed pigs on the temple altar. And then Matthias Maccabees finally has enough of this. And when he sees a Jew ready to offer a sacrifice on the altar, he has enough. He goes and he says in verse 24, he's inflamed with zeal, and he kills the Jew that was going to obey Antiochus. And then he cries with a loud voice, saying, "Whoever is zealous of the law and maintaineth the covenant, let him follow me." And so he and his sons fled to the mountains. And Matthias Maccabees, his son Judas, became his main leader, and they had guerrilla warfare for about 3 years. And they eventually came back and took over the temple, cleansed the temple, and reinstated the daily sacrifice. That was on December 25th, 164 BC. That's known what the Jews celebrate as Hanukkah. That's where that came from, when the Maccabees took back over and reinstated the sacrifice. All right, we're going to have to keep things moving. As far as the verse 13, where it says about 2,300 days till the sanctuary be cleansed, there's two views on that. The less common would be at the evenings and the mornings were each a day, so it was actually only 1,100, and that would be that was the amount of time. That would hold out to be about the amount of time that the altar was not being sacrificed upon. But there are problems with that view. I'd say the more common view is that it would be the literal 2,300 days, and that would go back to about 170 BC, which is about the time that Antiochus sold the high priesthood. He murdered the high priest and sold the position. We don't have exact dates for that, when that happened. We can't say that for sure, but that would be in the general time frame. All right. And it says, the last thing we know about Antiochus, and he shall be broken without hand. Antiochus died in 164 from a sudden illness. He wasn't overthrown by enemies. He wasn't assassinated. It wasn't in battle, but he died. Antiochus fits this description like a glove. I feel like I couldn't do it justice in this short amount of time. But let's just quickly recap. As we look at chapter 7, the bear raised up on one side and the ram in chapter 8 with one horn higher correctly prophesies the Medo-Persian Empire. The leopard in chapter 7 and the goat with one horn in chapter 8 correctly prophesies the Greek Empire and Alexander the Great and how he comes into power. The four heads of the leopard and the four small horns prophesy how Alexander's empire will be divided into four parts. The reign of the little horn, Antiochus Epiphanes, and how he came into power, what he should do, and how he would die. The temple being desecrated. If you want to look at more of this, I encourage you to watch Mike Winger. He has a video on YouTube, Proof for God, and he covers Daniel chapter 7 and 8. He goes into a bit more detail than what I did tonight, and it's a very compelling evidence for chapter 7 and 8 being fulfilled. I encourage you to watch that if you're interested. And then he also goes into chapter 11, which he claims is the most prophetic passage of the Bible. That's another video. And there's 135 prophecies in chapter 11, and a bit of them are about the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemy Empire and how they're all fulfilled to great detail. But I warn you, have your Bible in front of you and follow along, because you can get lost, or if I try to drive and do that, I get lost very quickly. But that's, if you enjoy prophecy, those are two videos I would highly recommend for you to watch. All right, we're going to wrap it up here. I was going to go over some evidence for Daniel being written by Daniel, but maybe I'll cover that tomorrow night. For tomorrow night, I'd like you to read Daniel chapter 6, a very famous story of Daniel in the lion's den. And I'm excited to end, hopefully on a practical note. Hopefully this prophecy has been inspiring to you, that we know we're following the true God, and that it should solidify our faith and make us firmly believe that Jesus is Messiah and we need to live our lives for him. So God bless each one of you. Thank you for your attention.
Welcome back from your classes. Turn with me in your books.